broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of the Investor Exchange. I'm your host today in the captain's chair, Louis van Copenhagen, and joining me in the studio is Brett Dickinson.
Morning, Captain.
And Joel Hewish.
Morning. How are we all?
Yes, very well. Very well. We had the first football match come back for the restart of the AFL season.
Yeah, the heavyweights were at it.
Yes, they were, weren't they? Yeah, a high-pressure match, but not quite the result that you guys were after.
Well, we're on top of the ladder. We'll take that for the time being, yep.
No, not at all, really. We were lucky to get away with the draw, to be honest with you. Richmond were probably better than us for 2.5 quarters, I'd say, and we were lucky to probably get away with the draw.
Yeah, they did have a little bit of help with the controversial goal they were allowed. But anyway, we won't gripe on that. We're used to doing that on close games.
Exactly.
A bit of sour grapes when calls don't go our way in close ones.
Yeah.
Joel, I know you follow a lot of sports around the world. What do you think the expansion in the AFL's reach might be? Given that it's restarting now, while a lot of other international sports are not yet up and running.
Oh, that's a damn good question, Louis. My gut instinct suggests that if there is any sort of bounce, it's more fleeting than sustained. Just pure and simply because in the months to come, many other sports are getting back to work. You've got the English Premier League starting in the next week or so. In fact, I think it starts this week. You've got some of the European other European leagues have already started or are starting, like the German soccer league has already started. You've got the NBA is looking like it's going to open up again in late July. The NHL looks like it's likely to open up again sometime in the next few weeks. So, you know, you've got college football looks like it's going to continue to go ahead. You've got the NFL looks like it's going to continue to go ahead, albeit with reduced levels of crowds or maybe no crowds in the initial phase. But, you know, I think Australia did the Australian Rules Football League did get some international attention when it was the only sport in town in round one, as all other leagues had sort of shut down. And certainly some of the Americans took notice of it. But I think when things go back to some sort of sense of normality and the other sporting leagues fire back up again, I suspect it'll still be an Australian game primarily.
I think so. It's really hard to change people's ingrained habits.
Yeah.
And when you're competing against someone's favourite sport, you're just not going to hold their attention once you've got the one against the other.
Correct. Right,
especially if you can't attend it and it's not in your face with local news, it's going to be hard to continue to have enthusiasm for it.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, that's right. So do we need an American Australian Football League, the AAFL?
We've got a great American player in the league, don't we?
We do.
Big fella?
Yep.
Oh,
Big Cox.
I heard he's only ever had one good game.
That's just the only one everyone remembers.
Yeah.
All right. Well, gents, let's get into the episode proper rather than shooting the breeze all day. Joel, why don't you give us some updates on what's happening in economies and share markets around the world?
Yes. Well, we have had a very strong May period. In fact, as we've discussed on multiple times through the podcast, we've had in recent months that the recovery has been quite strong, quite sustained, and probably confounded many experts and observers in terms of the strength that that this recovery has achieved, at least particularly in the US market. The Australian stock market, not as strong, but certainly last night gave everyone a wake-up call that the risks aren't behind us. In fact, this morning, as I woke up to record this podcast, I opened my iPhone only to find that the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down over 1,800 points, down by 6.9% last night in one trading session. The S&P 500 was down 5.89%, and the NASDAQ was down 5.27%. And if I'm having a look at the Australian futures at the moment, we are looking as though our stock market is going to open up at least 3% down. It doesn't look like it's going to be a good day for the Australian stock market. However, I'm actually putting together our monthly market update and just going through a number of technical studies and just trying to get a sense of, certainly there was a lot of evidence that this market in the US in particular was starting to get quite frothy and really needed a little bit of a pullback. And sometimes those pullbacks can be led by news headlines. I note that in the US, if you're looking, and we discussed this prior to coming on air, Louis, that if you're looking at more of the left-leaning news articles, apparently there's a huge new outbreak and a second wave of cases in the United States. But then if you have a read of the articles a little bit further on some of the right-leaning newspapers, it's only localized outbreaks. And in fact, the actual number of new coronavirus cases on aggregate across the U.S. is still coming down. So, look, whatever the cause of this sell-off is, there was no doubt about it that the market was primed for a sell-off and it just needed a reason. The recovery, we had the NASDAQ as it was now reaching all-time highs again. And only 3 months ago, the stock market, the NASDAQ was down by 34%. So that type of incredible selling followed by incredible buying set us up nicely for a decent pullback, and it looks like we're starting to get that now. My best observations and my best analysis is that this type of pullback is more likely than not. In fact, I have a fairly decent conviction in this, is that more likely than not that this is going to be a fairly healthy pullback in the confines of a general broader market recovery and bull market, to be honest with you. We're seeing plenty of indicators, sentiment indicators, breadth indicators, overbought indicators that were flashing red on the short term. But medium to longer term, the underlying technical picture for the market still remains very robust and quite favorable. I'm just going to read through some of these studies that just to give you an indication of what past types of setups that have been presenting over the past week or so have tended to lead to. So there's a particular indicator, a Fidelity's fund breadth indicator, which measures how many mutual funds have outperformed the short-term treasury bills over the past 3 months. Now, that reading has recently crossed above 94%, meaning that most funds have outperformed cash. Now, you'd expect that given that we've seen the rally that we have in the United States over the past 3 months. But when this happened in the past, stocks could pull back a little bit in the short term. And in fact, 1 month and 2 month and 3 month returns were pretty benign, really not doing much, only up by about 1%, 1.5% over the next 3 months. But 6 months later and 12 months later, you saw the stock market up by 6.28% and 12.34% on average over that period of time, with an 85% success rate 6 months later and a 96% success rate 12 months later. Now, that's backed up also by when this happens on the world stage. So having a look at the world MSCI index, When you see a similar type of development where most MSC, where most managed funds that international managed funds outperform treasuries, you tend to see a similar type of story internationally. You see in the short term, 1 to 2 months, in fact, over the next 1 to 2 weeks, you tend to see negative returns, but over 1 and 2 and 3 month periods, it's pretty benign, sort of 1 to 1.5% returns over those time frames. But 6 months later, you're seeing around about 3.7% for a 68% success rate, and at about a 10% rate of return, 12 months later with a 78% success rate. So it sort of indicates that we're in that environment where the next few months could be a little bit rocky. You might get some wild swings and gyrations, but we tend not to go too far. But later on down the track, the underlying environment is still supportive. When we have a look at the S&P 500, and we see that 10 of the 11 S&P 500 sectors have outperformed the 3 month Treasury yield over the past 3 months. Once again, this has usually led to some benign returns in the over the next 2 to 3 months. But over the next 6 to 12 months, you see generally a 7.4% return over the next 6 months with a 79% success rate. And over the next 12 months, you see a 15.7% rate of return with a 93% success rate. If we have a look at some other studies that I'm having a look at here, as a result of risk assets being bid up recently, we can see that in the US, the S&P 500 has rallied more than 8% over the last 11 days leading into the 10th of June, which is only a couple of days ago. And only 1 day ago when looking at the U.S. stock market. And we've also seen the U.S. dollar index, so the index that measures how the U.S. dollar is performing against a world basket of currencies, has fallen by 3%. Now, this is actually quite rare, and it's only happened a few times since over the last 20 years. Now, typically what it's indicated is that the S&P 500, once again, typically tends to pull back in the short term, when it rallies by more than 8% over the last 11 days, but the US dollar index drops by 3%. But over the next 6 months, the S&P 500 rallies on average at a medium level by around about 13.8% for a 100% success rate, and by 21.5% for an 86% success rate 12 months later. So we're seeing, you know, and there's more and more evidence. I mean, I've got a number of studies that I haven't mentioned here today that indicate the same thing. And the general story is that we're in an environment where the underlying picture is more around a recovery. Most of these instances that we've seen where we're tracking these types of technical setups suggest that the stock market underneath it all is quite healthy and it's going through a recovery phase. Yet we're extended in the short term, and a correction of somewhere between sort of 5 to 10% is certainly within the realms of a possibility here. Generally, the returns over the next 3 to 4 months or so are quite benign, but because the underlying improvement in the stock market and the economy and the recovery that we tend to be seeing is still playing out, we tend to see that results 6 months and 12 months out are quite strong and quite supportive of higher stock prices over the next 12 months. We want to also pair that with the fact that we've seen a really surprising U.S. jobs report come out in the last week. Analysts were expecting 6 million jobs to have been lost in the United States in the most recent jobs report that came out last week, and in fact, the U.S. economy added 2 million. Now, to give you some sort of context in terms of how wild these swings have been and how badly the economists got this jobs report expectation, a bad number is usually somewhere around about a loss of 200,000 jobs, and a good number is a gain of some 200,000 jobs. Now, analysts were expecting 6 million jobs to be lost, and yet the U.S. economy added 2 million. So it just gives you an indication of how wild the economic data has been and how hard it is to really predict what's going on.
Wow. Well, maybe those forecasters should lose their jobs.
We've also seen some interesting reports, economic reports coming out of China. The purchasing managers index and the manufacturing indexes in China have now both ticked above 50. Now, for those people who are new to reading this type of data, basically a measure of 50 indicates that the economy in China, is, at least in the manufacturing industry, in the manufacturing sector in China, is back in growth phase. So the biggest manufacturer in the world, the biggest economy that manufactures products and goods, is back to growing the amount of production that it is producing. We've also seen some business confidence surveys here in Australia. Although they are still in negative territory, there has certainly been a very, very strong recovery in a number of these business sentiment surveys. Treasury is now revising down its expectation for the peak in unemployment here in Australia. Originally, they were expecting anywhere between sort of up to around about a 10% unemployment rate by the end of September. And an 8% unemployment rate by around the end of June. That's now been revised to a peak of not more than 8% by in this cycle. So we're seeing some tentative signs that that the worst case scenario at this stage is not playing out, and that the recovery appears to be underway as economies start to open up. We do need to be aware of the fact that there could be a second wave of viruses outbreaking, but I'm not so certain that many governments are very willing to go back to the levels of shutdown across the broad economy and risk a major depression and 10 years of pain and disaster. I suspect that political incentives will probably stop many governments from going back into those severe levels of enforced shutdowns. Many of the governments have also now prepared their intensive care units with ventilators and have improved their levels of testing. So I suspect that most of the strategy from here, from most governments and most health organizations, is going to be around trying to quickly identify where the hotspots are as they break out and selectively isolate those areas rather than going into a full-blown lockdown of their economies again. I think that everyone recognizes that unemployment and mass unemployment and an economic depression could have greater health ramifications than perhaps a virus that it does have a pretty decent mortality rate, but at the same time they're trying to find that balance between, you know, is the cure worse than the crisis?
Mm. Joel, the best way I've heard the potential second wave described is as ripples rather than a big wave coming out as multiple ripples, where you've got small localized hotspots. And in addition to hospital facilities being beefed up and ready for increases in potential cases, you've also got increased capacities in contact traces and a better development of the COVID app, so it might actually work. From what I'm hearing, as it's, whether it works or not, much better ability to clamp down on a hotspot or a cluster when it breaks out, so that it's localized to less than 100 people, or even less than 10 people, rather than getting away from it and becoming a wave of thousands.
Yeah, that's right, and that's consistent with the information that I'm hearing as well, Louis.
So very interesting to get the insight on the impact on markets and where markets are headed and the thoughts around the economic leaders. We will cut to a break now, and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
And we're back. Joel, you touched on something around the different messages you're getting from different news websites. And it's an interesting perspective. I get a certain feeling from news websites. And in Australia, I would categorize us as being in the pandemic decline phase. And what I'm noticing is that not all news websites are really reading it that way, or certainly not triggering that kind of response.
Yeah.
What I mean is that in the early days of the pandemic, it was really a perfect storm for the media when you've got a situation of global importance with potential catastrophic results. The early days of coronavirus was really this feeling of what the hell is going on, and this search for information mixed with fear and importance, and you've got leaders of Australia and the world all talking about it. It is a real bonanza for news websites. When every day is bringing new questions and a little bit of new information, but mostly a lack of information. And then through the escalation of the pandemic, people just continue to search for more information, and still that fear of the potential scenarios and watching it play out in real time. Then we had the peak of it, and very much the decline from the peak is underway, and in many states of Australia we're at low or zero community transfer cases. New South Wales and Victoria are still trying to get to zero community transfer cases. The majority of new cases coming out recently are still people returning from international travel. But what I'm not always seeing is a difference in the style of news reporting. And what I mean by that is when I scroll through the headlines of a news website, what is the response that's triggered in me? Because remember what a newspaper's job is. What are they actually trying to do?
Sell advertising.
They're trying to sell advertising, exactly. Now, in the old days, pre-internet, all a newspaper had to do was be good enough for you to buy it again the next day.
Yep. Yeah.
Didn't matter whether you read it a long time or a little bit of time. Some people bought it just for the comics. Some people bought it for the classifieds. Didn't really matter. Some people bought it for the investigative journalism. Great. So whatever the reason is, they just needed to buy the next day. Or the sport. There you go. Exactly. what is it now? Now that we're in the internet era, it's all measured by the things like the number of clicks you make on the website, the length of time. They can tell whether you've scrolled down to a certain part of the website. So the amount of data that they have on people's behaviors when they're on the website is huge. Mm. And every second is measured. So how does a news website maximize your time on the website and the number of repeat visits? What they're looking for is your emotional triggers to stay longer and to come back again. So what was great for news websites in the early days was that people were in this state of fear and looking for more information and coming back and searching and reading more and getting every article that they could on coronavirus to try and meet that and have that emotional side of them satisfied as best they could, which then gets them to come back the next day and do it again. Now that we're in the panic decline, I'm finding that news websites are still hitting those fear buttons and they're still triggering that same emotional response like we're in a giant panic situation when actually we're in the panic decline. And I'm noticing that for some people, it's actually preventing them from getting on with their lives.
Right, really?
And that's where, from a personal finance point of view, I think people just need to be aware that this is what's going on. With pandemic escalation, I'm cool with whatever your behavior was during that. But I'm just noticing that in the panic decline stage, I've got this divergence between the relevance of the news and the amount of fear that it's triggering in me as well and other people. There's this divergence between the amount of fear and the fear that is actually needed to be had. And my reason for bringing it up is just for people to be aware of it and conscious of it. If you're finding that you're stuck in a fear cycle, if you do that for too long, it's going to lead to situations that are not in your best interest. And that's for any situation where people are stuck in a fear cycle, whether it's a global pandemic or whether it's something in someone's personal life. When you're stuck in a fear cycle for a long time, then it's not good for your body because of its stress levels. It's not good for your brain because it inhibits your brain function when you're in that state for too long. A little bit of stress can be a good thing. And we've all been in work situations where we've had stress for a short period of time and we really power through the work. Stress and fear for a short period of time can be a great motivator and a great productivity tool. But when you extend it over a long period of time, you get negative health outcomes, your brain doesn't work, and it leads to burnout. Your decisions are not as good. Your decisions are not as long-term in their focus.
And it's just a shit feeling.
And it's just a shit feeling. Thank you, Brett. Yeah, exactly. So I just wanted to highlight for listeners who might be in that state, yes, we are still in a global pandemic here. So the question from me for people to think about and be aware of is, how do we remain vigilant but also realistic, and how do we continue to get on with our own lives in a way that is in a reduced state of fear and actually looking positively for what are the next steps? And I don't think the news websites are always helping. But I will flag the Herald Sun as being a great website for reporting on other stuff, especially sports. When I look at the Herald Sun, it's a series of articles about other stuff and nonsense, and there's still there's still some great hot button pushing headlines like, oh, what the hell is that? So it's still getting that reaction, but there's a really good mixture of sport and random nonsense and engaging pictures of handsome people and pretty people. So there you go. Shout out for the Herald Sun.
Just enough trash to keep your mind off the coronavirus, right?
Exactly. A good trash rag. So look, that's what I wanted to flag for today.
Good call.
Yeah. And Joel, you mentioned the difference between the left papers and the right papers. And left-leaning papers every day, there's something about Donald Trump being the enemy of the world or being a giant buffoon. And then you look at the right and it's not the case. So,
what I've actually noticed more so than anything is that the left-leaning papers are very hysterical around the waves of the outbreak and the supposed mishandling of the outbreak in the United States, and they're really politicizing this virus and its handling now, and the right is just doing the exact opposite and downplaying the severity of what's going on and praising the performance of Donald Trump and trying to get him reelected. And it's unfortunately the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
yeah
seems to be the case.
That's right. And I don't think any news outlet wants to fairly apportion blame? Because that's not a very interesting story, is it?
No.
It's not very interesting for someone to say, oh, well, you're both kind of right and you're both kind of wrong, and blame probably lies a little bit here and a little bit there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not interesting. If I started a newspaper, no one would buy it.
No clicks.
All right, very good. We'll kick over to another break. We'll be back shortly.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And hello again. Back into it. Brett, you've got some updates for us as well.
Sure do, Louis. Yeah, given that we're into June now, some of the data that CoreLogic put together on the residential real estate markets come through for May, I thought was worth touching on. Obviously, the forecasters have had their say, and we've touched on what a lot of the economics and the banks are trying to forecast around the property market for the foreseeable future. Similar to what Joel touched on, what they're forecasting and what we're seeing aren't necessarily the same. There's quite a disparity at this point in time. So I'll talk about the stats that CoreLogic have come up with. First of all, listings. We knew that the property market had slowed in terms of volumes of sales, but some positivity over the last month. It's up. So the CoreLogic stats show that listings are actually up compared to last month by 18%, and that was up 5.5% for the last week. So it shows there's a lot more buoyancy and a lot more people willing to come to market.
Right.
But when we compare it to the year, we're down 26% in total listings compared to this time last year. So we're lower, but we're trending up. So as Louis said, you know, we seem to be coming through the recovery phase of the pandemic, and this data says that people seem to believe that with their willingness to get back into the market. Values is the outcome most people want to find out about, because that's where, you know, they see their wealth lying in terms of property, whether it's in property they own or they're looking to buy. And with all the forecasts saying that the housing market's going to decline, well, the facts at the moment, we can only go off the data that's available, says that the total values across Australia in the last month are down 0.5%. So virtually a neutral game. Yes, it's a loss, but it's not a significant enough loss to say it's, you know, it's having a massive impact. It's certainly not growth, we can say that. But given the low volumes and, you know, the lack of data compared to what we'd regularly have, it's hard to see that there's any real shift in the property market on that figure. So the part I find interesting is when I look at a chart that CoreLogic put together that just shows the last sort of 6 months and how values have changed, you can sort of see a peak in the recent period in around mid-March, where it shows growth was at just over 1%, and then the trend line just continues downward, growth mid-May, and then we're down to like the 0.5% decline in June. So if that trend continues in that direction, well, yes, we will see the declines that all the forecasters are talking about. But I guess we'll have to wait until next month to see what the data tells us then around that issue.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, that's another month of data, and it's a critical month of data, which everyone was really worried about with what the outcome would be.
Yeah. Yeah, so a 0.5% decline, but the trend line is certainly downwards.
So, Brett, what is the what's the overall decline from the peak?
I'm only looking at the peak, the most recent peak in this chart. So it's just from the start of the year, and it shows that the growth rate was the highest in mid-March at 1.2%.
Right, okay.
And from there, it's been just a constant decline down to the 0.5% decline in growth last month.
Okay.
But if we look at it on an annual basis, overall values are still up 8.3% from this time last year.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And in the capital cities, that's 9.7% compared to this time last year.
Right. Mm.
So anyone that's worried about their house price, well, compared to last year, you're still in positive territory by quite a way.
Yeah. Yep. And certainly doesn't follow the possible path for the major declines that that a lot of forecasters were worried about.
The only thing that I see heading in that direction is that short-term trend line that from that March 1.2% high of the recent data to where we are today. If that trend continues, we're probably going to be, you know, maybe at negative 1% next month, 1.5%. You know, if we're dropping at 0.5% per month, which is kind of what's happening, maybe we will see it get there. But given that, you know, the restrictions are eased, there's more people in the market, there's a bit more consumer confidence, we might see it just level out and potentially even start to increase towards the latter half of the year.
Well, I wonder what would feel like an okay level of decline. I mean, we have had this massive impact, and I feel like if we came through this period of time with a property market decline of 5%, I don't think people would really care much. I think if we got out of this with a 5% decline in property market, we'd be like, well, that's pretty cool. We got through that okay. And I think what people are more worried about is a potential 10%, 15% or 20% decline.
Yeah.
And Louis, if that was the bottom, a 5% decline across the market, we would still be up by around 5% from May 2019.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Jeez. So
it wouldn't be all bad.
Yeah. So it's almost like we've got a bit of buffer for more declines being okay in the coming months.
Potentially, yeah. It's crystal balling again. We don't know. We've just got to continue to monitor. But at this stage, we're not seeing any real reasons for panic or concern.
Mm, okay. Well, that's fascinating. So I guess the things in my mind is continuing to see that data come out, and also just being aware of the potential end of the bank repayment holidays, which are expected around September.
Yep.
Again, those news articles keep coming up about the cliff edge in September. But it's not like policymakers and bank executives can't see that coming, and they'll take steps to make sure that we don't just step off a cliff. That's what people and leaders do.
Yeah, Louis, that's the big factor I think we need to be mindful of here is I don't think we're going to know the full extent of COVID-19 on the housing market until the end of the year, because if those incentives are dropped, like you say, the mortgage deferrals were for 6 months and the JobKeeper that's been allowed for I think they're both going to end around the same time in September. It's only a month or two after that that we'll find out if there's a lot of forced sellers that would potentially cause a decline. So I think we're probably not going to see any major movements until the end of that period.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Indeed. Well, thanks for the update, Brett. Was there anything else from you?
Well, mate, I've got plenty of other stuff. Have we got time?
I'm wondering if there's any positioning around the home builder scheme, and are you seeing measures for builders or developers really putting out messages around it and capitalising on it straight away?
Well, mate, if I was to put my marketing hat on, I've seen a table of information today. I think if I'm a builder, this is exactly the data I would want to know. It tells us where the top 10 regions around the country are, where there's the highest volume of owner-occupied properties worth less than $1.5 million. So right in the catchment of who qualifies. And of that, they've even put them in order to say not only who's got the highest volume, but they also qualify where they've got data to say that the portion of those properties have household income less than 200,000, which is the second criteria.
Right.
So to give an example, the southeast region of Melbourne, which they're saying is basically from Waverley out to Bunyip, that whole band through there, has 160,000 owner-occupied properties, and 94% of them are on $200,000 or less. So that's 160,000 properties that would be eligible for the Home Builder Grant.
Wow. Okay.
So if I'm a Melbourne-based builder that is looking for a catchment, that would be an area I would certainly focus on.
Yeah. Okay. Very good.
There's data showing regions all around the country where there's at least 100,000 in a catchment area with 80-plus percent of those candidates likely to be eligible.
All right.
Anyone that is a builder and is looking for where they think their next round of clients could come from, this is on the Urban Developer. It's an article, and it's got tables showing where the regions around Australia with the highest volume of sub $1.5 million properties with incomes that qualify.
There you go. We're a very interesting podcast, aren't we? All right. Well, thanks, Brett. Well, next on our weekly podcast agenda is our favourite section.
Da-da-da-da.
Who's got something today?
Yeah, I do. I came across a guy that's search for fame took him to lengths that we've sort of heard of before, but he's taken it to a step further than I've heard of anyone. Now, the name Dino Wilson is one that you probably will never remember, but the new name he has, you've definitely seen up in lights, and hence his reason for changing it. So he'd had a bet with his friends years ago saying that everyone will know his name one day. He'll be so famous that the whole world will recognize it. So he went ahead and changed his name from Dino Wilson to Fire Exit. And his name is now up in lights across the world.
Oh, wow.
Jeez.
There's lots of online shopping happening at the moment, and some retailers, when you open up their box, they've put in an extra gift or something for you. Someone from Amazon has told shoppers to look out for an extra special gift which shouldn't have been there. It was her engagement ring.
Ooh.
So a newly engaged Amazon worker who was recently engaged to another Amazon employee said she was packing boxes, and as lots of newly engaged people do, they look at their rings from time to time, and in the last hour of her shift, she just noticed, oh, shit, my ring's gone. She reckons she packs 160 packages an hour, which I think pretty quick rate of packing parcels.
Yeah.
Shut down the warehouse to try and look for it, and they couldn't find it, so she reckons it's in one of the boxes that she's packed. She's taken to social media to tell people to please look out for my engagement ring.
Hopefully the message gets there.
Yeah, either that or someone's just pocketed an engagement ring, bonus engagement ring with, I don't know, their dish soap or whatever they bought from Amazon.
Thanks, Amazon.
CDs. Do people still buy CDs? Whatever it is.
Yep.
All right, thanks for joining us again for another week, listeners. We'll be back again with more wonderful content next week. Thank you, Brett. Thank you,
pleasure,
Joel.
Louis. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Louis. Thanks, we'll guys. Thanks, listeners. Cheers.